We're in 1 Samuel chapter 25, and we've been talking about the different heroes. Love to pick out the hero stories in Samuel. You know, we talk about David and Goliath. We did about Jonathan facing the Philistines single-handedly and all this kind of cool stuff. This morning we're going to look at a hero, but it's a gal. It's a girl. We're going to look at the life of a lady. Gals, those of you who were at the retreat last weekend, we talked about the mighty men of David. We talked about, you know, what God wants to do in our lives. He wants us to be mighty men. He can take a bunch of nothings and turn them into mighty men. Well, this morning you guys are back, and so we're going to look at a hero, but it's a gal. It's a gal. Now, I know that the feminine is heroine, but we just, that kind of makes people think weird things. So, we're in 1 Samuel 25, verse 2. And there was a man in Maon whose possessions were in Carmel. And the man was very great. And he had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. And he was shearing his sheep in Carmel. Now, there's two Carmels, at least, in the Bible. And then if you count the one up in Northern California, there's three. There's the one that's up in Northern Israel, and that's where Elijah had his showdown. Remember, they called fire down from heaven. But that's in the Northern of Israel. This is in Southern Israel. This is down in the area of Judah. This is south of the city of Hebron. So it's a different place. Don't think it's the same place where Elijah was. And this guy is, there's a wealthy man. He's a part of the story. He's got 3,000 sheep, 1,000 goats, and it's time to shear the sheep. It's time to get a haircut. They only get once a year a haircut. Verse 3, and the name of the man was Nabal. Now, I know the name is actually pronounced Nabal or Nabal, but I'm sorry, I've got 30 years of calling him Nabal, and that's the way we're going to hear him today. We're going to call him Nabal. Because it sounds a little more appropriate. Oh, Nabal. You Nabal. His name means foolish. Sometimes Bible names have significance. Sometimes I think we stretch it a little too much to make things have significance. But often Bible names do have significance. Now, I don't know why in the world his parents named him this. Out comes the baby. What did you gonna name this kid? Fool. We're gonna call him Fool. It's not very nice, parents. Don't do this with your child. Don't name your child this, okay? Don't call your children Fool either. And so the name of the man was Fool. We're gonna talk about this in a little bit, what it means. And the name of his wife, this gal's the hero, Abigail. Her name, it could mean my father is joy, but also could mean the joy of her father. And I kind of think that's probably what it was. You know, when you get to know her, I'm sure she was the joy of her father. It says she was a woman of good understanding. This gal's smart. She's sharp. This gal's top of her class, gets A's and everything. This gal is sharp as a tack. Good understanding. She's got the brains and of a beautiful countenance. And the words here describe just me. She's a good-looking woman. This is a good-looking woman. She's smart. She's beautiful. But the man, it says, was churlish. That's a good King James word we ought to bring back. Churlish, it means harsh or cruel or obstinate, hard. He's a mean guy. And evil in his doings. Everything he did was just, guy was just... It's a bad apple. It's evil in his doings. And he was of the house of Caleb. Now, I'm sure the other Caleb is just as shocked as you are. This is this guy's with this descendant of one of the heroes of Israel, one of the leaders of the tribe of Judah. He's a giant killer, Caleb. He was one of the two spies that spied out the land that came back and said, we can do this. Caleb, he's a great guy, and I'm sure he was sitting in the bosom of Abraham going, oh, don't tell the story of Nabal again. Oh, man, I wish this kid was never born. Nabal apparently has inherited at least part of the estate. He's the guy's wealthy, he's well off, he's got lands, he's got sheep and goats and stuff. Probably has some advantage because of all of this. That's probably why they mention he's of Caleb. But he ain't nothing like Caleb. My first point, don't be a fool. Don't be a fool. No, this isn't just for the men. I know that we're all going to, all the girls are going to keep elbowing the guys all during the message, and the guys are going to go, okay, already, okay, you know. I know that's going to happen. And then all the guys in this whole story, every guy in this story has got problems. Even David, this is one of David's bad chapters. David's doing stupid stuff. You know, so I'm sorry, guys, you're going to get railed on today. But this goes for all of us. Don't be a fool. Don't be a fool. Now, I did some homework and come to find that there's actually like four different Hebrew words that are translated fool. So there's quite a variety of words, and they are quite different. And the Bible will translate each of these four different words as fool. You know, one of them is kind of like the airhead. You know, it means lots of space in between the ears. You know, it's got a big head, but there's nothing in there. You know, okay, George, which way do we go, George? You know, somebody who, I'm going to offend some people, somebody who might say, they're blonde. I want to tell you a blonde joke. Hold on, blonde people, you're going to love this joke. A blonde and a lawyer are seated next to each other on a flight from L.A. to New York. The lawyer asks if she would like to play a game. The blonde, tired, just wants to take a nap, politely declines and rolls over to the window to catch a few winks. The lawyer persists and explains that the game is easy and a lot of fun. He explains, I ask you a question, and if you don't know the answer, you pay me $5, and vice versa. Again, she declines and tries to get some sleep. The lawyer, now agitated, says, okay, if you don't know the answer, you pay me $5, and if I don't know the answer, I will pay you $500. This catches the blonde's attention. And figuring there will be no end to this torment unless she plays the game, she agrees. The lawyer asks the first question. What is the distance from the earth to the moon? The blonde doesn't say a word, reaches into her purse and pulls out a $5 bill, hands it to the lawyer. Okay, says the lawyer, it's your turn. She asks the lawyer, what goes up a hill with three legs and comes down with four legs? The lawyer, puzzled, takes out his laptop computer and searches all his references. No answer. He taps into the airphone with his modem and searches the internet and Library of Congress. No answer. Frustrated, he sends emails to all his friends and coworkers. No avail. After an hour, he wakes the blonde and hands her $500. The blonde says, well, thank you. He turns back to get some more sleep. The lawyer, who is a little more than miffed, wakes the blonde and asks, well, what's the answer? Without a word, the blonde reaches into her purse, hands the lawyer $5. And you thought all blondes were dumb. Okay, when I say don't be a fool, we're not talking about that. We're not talking about being stupid. We're not talking about being dumb or something like that. That's not what Nabal means. I'll give you three words that help you understand the word Nabal or Nabal. First word is this. It Nabal, a fool, is insensitive. The fool is insensitive. That's part of what this fool is. This is a person who doesn't care about other people. And the Bible calls this person a fool. Peter says in 1 Peter 3:7, likewise, ye husbands, dwell with your wives according to knowledge, giving honor unto the wife as unto the weaker vessel, and as being heirs together of the grace of life, that your prayers be not hindered. See, the fool is insensitive, but, for example, in marriage, God commands husbands to learn to understand your wife. Make her your lifelong study. Get your doctorate, get your graduate degree on her. Find out what makes her tick. Now, guys make jokes about this. They say, "Oh, what do you mean, understand a woman? Can't be done." Well, you know what? God commands you to. God commands you to get your doctorate on her. Study her. Understand. Why is she do this? Why is she acting this way? Why is she hurt? What did you do to hurt her? He says, give her, treat her with respect, honor as a fellow heir. Treat her as valuable. He says, treat her as unto the weaker vessel. It doesn't say she is necessarily the weaker vessel. And often our wives are far stronger than we are. But you are to treat her as if she is the weaker vessel. You treat her with kid gloves like fine china. Now, Nabal is insensitive. And, oh, just get out of here. Get out of my face. I'm going to go do my thing. Get out of here. Insensitive. Don't be a fool. Don't be insensitive. Another word is unreasonable. The fool is a person you can't talk to without being insulted. They're unreasonable. You're going to see that with Nabal when some people come to talk to Nabal. Oh, he just is in their face firing in one insult after another. And people will say about Nabal, well, you know, Nabal, nobody can talk to him. You can't talk to this guy without him, you know, biting your ear off or something. You know, the guy is just, he's unreasonable. The fool has harsh, lying words. Let me ask you this. Can someone talk to you in a way that will make you actually change your mind about something? Or are you a person who always has their mind made up and nothing's going to change your mind? You think the way you want to think and nobody's going to make you change your mind. Well, you know what? The Bible says you're a fool if you don't pay attention and listen to what other people say. Doesn't mean you have to agree. But a fool is unreasonable. Lastly, a fool is ungodly. A fool is ungodly. David uses this word in Psalm 14:1. He says, the fool, and the word is Nabal. You could say Nabal. He says, the fool hath said in his heart, or you could say Nabal hath said in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt. They have done abominable works. There is none that doeth good. There's nothing so insensitive or so foolish as a person who won't recognize who God is and what God wants to do. It's the fool that says, oh, gee, don't do this God thing. That's foolish. That's foolish. Personally, I know we get this idea when you go to school that somehow science disproves God. That's what the secular mindset is that the good scientist, every good scientist knows that, you know, it's just all evolution. It's proven. It's fact. That's an old, outdated, stupid mindset. The more science grows, the deeper it goes. I mean, what's this whole human genome project? You know, this thing where they've got these companies that are trying to unravel the mystery of DNA and all the thousands, millions of combinations that make up the human chromosome. Yeah, absolutely incredible. When you think of you know, this big controversial thing that's happening now where they're cloning stuff. You know, latest thing a week or two ago, some company just, you know, they had cloned the household cat. Oh, boy, now we got more cats. Sorry. That probably offended some people. Sorry. God bless your cat. Okay. You're welcome. Okay. But what's the idea of a clone? That one single cell has enough genetic coding into it to be able to replicate kidneys, heart, liver, spine, bones, flesh, legs, where the ears go, how the nose works, the eyes, the intricacy of the eyes, the idea of an organ so complex that it can take light waves and decode them and help you see something that you can't touch that's across the room. I mean, think about all of this. Incredibly complex. What does that talk about? Somebody put this together. Not an accident. Years ago, Isaac Newton, you know that guy with the apple on the head thing? Okay, Isaac Newton. Many years ago, Sir Isaac Newton had an exact replica of our solar system made in miniature. At its center was he made the whole thing, you know, the sun, and he had little bars going out holding the planets, and he put gears and belts and stuff all in so that as the thing turns, it all turns exactly, you know, with the perfect motion of the planets. And he was sitting there in his lab one day studying this thing. And a friend walks in who's not a believer, doesn't believe in the God of creation. And the friend was watching this intricate design and all the gears and the belts and everything. And he said, Wow, Isaac, that is like the coolest thing. Who made that for you? And Isaac kind of was playing with his head and he said, oh, nobody. Nobody made it for me. It just appeared one day out of nowhere. You know, and the friend got the point. Of course not. We look at things. You know, if you find my watch laying on the floor, and you look at that, and you think, how many of you will look at that watch and say, "My, what an amazing freak of natural selection that through millions of years this thing just happened to come about? Amazing! How did this happen? And think that after millions of years it's still ticking. Oh, it's amazing!" No, the complexities of nature speak of God. A fool says there is no God. I'm not saying that to mock or to make fun of people who have talked themselves out of believing in God. But it's blindness. You know, and in a sense, beloved, sometimes we're there too, aren't we? We call ourselves believers. But do we really believe that God's there? Do we really act as if He is? It's foolishness. So, first point, don't be a fool. Don't want to be a fool. You can be blonde, but don't be a fool. You could even be stupid, but don't be a fool. Don't be insensitive. Okay, so let's get through this story here. So verse 4. So David heard in the wilderness that Nabal did shear his sheep. This is something that happens once a year around June or July, and you give the sheep all a haircut. It's big party time. It's kind of like, you know, at the harvest festival, and it's like having gathered in all the grain. Well, now they've gathered in all the wool, and they give presents to each other, and they stay up all night and tell funny stories, and they just have a great time. And so David hears about this, and David sent out 10 young men, and David said unto the young men, get you up to Carmel and go to Nabal and greet him in my name. And thus shall ye say to him that liveth in prosperity, peace be both to thee and peace be to thine house. And peace be unto all that thou hast. So he's going to send these guys up and say, man, how are you doing? And now I have heard that thou hast shearers. Now thy shepherds, which were with us, we hurt them not, neither was there aught any missing unto them all the while they were in Carmel. Ask thy young men, and they will show thee. Wherefore, let the young men find favor in thine eyes, for we come in a good day. Give, I pray thee, whatsoever cometh into thine hand, unto thy servant and to thy son David. Now, what's David doing here? See, David has been in this area for a while. We saw in chapter 23, he had been hanging out in the same vicinity. And what he has been doing is he's been offering a service to all the shepherds in the area. He's been protecting them from Philistines, wild animals, and stuff like that. And he says, you know what, let's see if the guy will share a little bit. You know, we could use some provisions. And so we're not asking for filet mignon. We're not asking for, you know, $3 million or, you know, or your life. You know, where he just said, hey, you got something to help out. And David's young men came. They spake to Nabal according to all these words in the name of David, and they ceased. In other words, they gave just what David said, and that's all they gave. And Nabal answered David's servants and said, who is David? And who is the son of Jesse? That's because David's the son of Jesse. There be many servants nowadays that break away every man from his master. You know, I've heard about David. I heard he's just a rebellious master against Saul. I know he's nothing but a troublemaker. Is that so? Is that true? No, that's a twist of the truth. It's a lie. David has always served Saul. It's that Saul is jealous and trying to kill David. He says, shall I take then my bread and my water and my flesh that I have killed for my shearers and give it unto men whom I know not whence they be? I don't know who you guys are. I don't know if you're good boys or not. So David's young men turned their way and went again and came and told him all those things. And David said unto his men, gird ye on every man his sword. And they girded on every man his sword. And David also girded on his sword. And there went up with David about 400 men, and 200 men stayed at camp, abode by the stuff. David is ticked off. He has had it up to here with people abusing him. I mean, he's been putting up with his boss chucking spears at him for no good reason. You know, what is this? Why can't somebody give me some respect? So he just had it. He's frustrated. This is not a good thing for David. David's getting himself into trouble here. He'll recognize that. He'll say that at the end. It's not a good thing. But one of the young men told Abigail. One of the young men told Abigail, Nabal's wife. This is one of Nabal's guys tells Abigail, saying, behold, David sent messengers out of the wilderness to salute our master, and he railed on them. He chewed them out. He was not a very nice guy. But the men were very good unto us, and we were not hurt, neither missed we anything, as long as we were conversant with them. When we were in the fields, they were a wall unto us, both by night and day, all the while we were with them keeping the sheep. In other words, these guys are really, really cool. They were so neat. They protected us all the time. Now, therefore, know and consider what thou wilt do, for evil is determined against our master and against all our household. For he is such a son of Belial that a man cannot speak to him. This servant is saying this to Abigail, the wife. He is such a son of Belial, such a worthless person, that nobody can talk to him. I think it's interesting that she doesn't get mad at him. How dare you think that about my husband? No, she knows it's true. Interesting. And Abigail made haste, took 200 loaves, probably kind of like, you know, loaves of pita bread kind of thing, and two bottles of wine. They would take an entire goat skin, you know, kind of peel it right off the goat and sew up the ends. And that would be their bottles of wine. So it's pretty good sized bottles. I mean, these are big old things. They're filled with wine. Five sheep ready dressed. In other words, wearing tuxedos. Now that's a thought. These are sheep that are already slaughtered, ready to be barbecued. Five measures of parched corn or roasted grain, and five measures, a little less than a bushel. It's kind of like the size of a good office trash can full of grain. That's about how much. 100 clusters of raisins and 200 cakes of figs. They take the figs, they dry them, and they stick them in clumps, and that becomes one of these cakes of figs. So don't think of fruit cake or something like that. These are clumps of figs. And they laid them on asses. And she said unto her servants, go on before me. Behold, I come after you. But she told not her husband, Nabal. The idea is that she sends the servants with the presents, with the gifts, with the food. She sends them on ahead So they'll get to David first. It's kind of like with Jacob and Esau, where Jacob sent the presents on ahead so that Esau would be kind of buttered up a little bit. And the idea is she wants David to be in a good mood so that when she comes, he'll listen to her and they'll be able to talk. But she told not her husband Nabal. If you're taking notes, the next point in my message is this: how to teach your husband a lesson. I know that sounds kind of funny, but that's the point. How to teach your husband a lesson. Ladies, take notes here. Here we go. Take notes. Let's look at 1 Peter chapter 3. 1 Peter chapter 3. How to teach your husband a lesson. The Bible does give women instruction on how to teach their husbands a lesson. Gals are all anxiously waiting. What in the world is he going to tell us? Woo-wee! I can hardly. This has got to be good. Honey, you can go now. Here. Okay, 1 Peter chapter 3. I'm going to read the New American Standard. Verse 1. In the same way, you wives, be submissive to your own husbands. Oh,
you tricked us.
Yep, I did. In the same way, you wives, be submissive to your own husbands, so that even if any of them are disobedient to the word, in other words, they need to learn a lesson, they may be won without a word by the behavior of their wives. In other words, they will learn a lesson. Be submissive to your own husbands, so that even if any of them are disobedient to the word, they may be won without a word by the behavior of their wives. Verse 2, as they observe your chaste and respectful behavior, and let not your adornment be merely external, braiding the hair and wearing gold jewelry or putting on dresses, but let it be the hidden person of the heart, with the imperishable quality of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is precious in the sight of God. For in this way, in former times, the holy women also who hoped in God used to adorn themselves, being submissive to their own husbands. This is how the gals in the old days used to get their beauty makeovers, he's saying, is by being submissive. Thus Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, and you have become her children if you do what is right, without being frightened by any fear. Now, you're going to think, if you think about this, we're talking about Abigail. Abigail is not being submissive to her husband. She is the exception to the rule, and we'll talk about that in a minute. Before we talk about the exception to the rule, it's important to know the general rule, 9 out of 10 times kind of a thing. And it's this: to be submissive. That's how a husband learns, Peter says. Now, this idea of submission, some people have the idea that submit means to shut up and obey. Talked about gentle, quiet spirit. So, without a word, so shut up, woman, and obey me. Well, I got to point some things out here. The one to follow, the example to follow, gals, is Sarah.
Yeah, called him Lord. That's what it says. She called him Lord.
But hold on a second. Of all the women in the Bible, do you know a single woman who told her husband more things what to do than Sarah? That's Sarah. She's always telling Abraham what to do.
Take Hagar, marry the gal. Oh, don't get rid of Hagar. I don't like her anymore and stuff.
Your ideas. You share your ideas. And then back off and let him learn to make decisions. See, I regret saying this every time I say this. But I think women seem to have a better knack at making decisions than guys. It seems to be that way. In most cases, I see. They a little bit quicker, a little bit, oh yeah, we should go that way. And I got, you know, come to a crossroads. Wife goes, yeah, oh, yeah, that way. And the guy just goes,
which way do I go? I go left, I go, oh, I don't know. I go right, oh, no, I don't know. Which way should I go? I don't know. I flip the coin. Oh, I don't like that. I want to flip it again, you know. And we go on and on and on trying to make decisions. And wife goes, just go left.
And then the guy goes, well, I'll go right. And then he runs into the dead end. And he says, oh, okay. Well, that happens so often, doesn't it? Happens so often. But see, the way he learns sometimes is by making a mistake. And not by you nagging him and saying, well, I told you you should have gone left. I told you you should have gone left. No, but, you know, honey, here we go. I think you ought to go left. And now I'm going to support you in whatever you do. And see, God wants men to learn to be strong men, decisive. But sometimes what we do, guys, is we bail on life. And we're smart enough to go, no, she's smarter than me. I'll let her drive. And so we come up to the crossroads, and I say, well, I don't care what we do, whatever you want. And I go take sit in the back seat. And what happens? She'll get in and she'll drive. Oh yeah. And you know what? You become a wimp. And you find yourself on your own someday where you got to make decisions and you don't know what to do. No, you need to learn to make decisions. And gals, sometimes the only way he's going to do that is if you let him. Let him make decisions. And yes, sometimes he's going to make mistakes. Hopefully he will learn and wisen up sooner or later that one day that you are his bestest advisor. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. You want to teach your husband a lesson? Let him drive. Let him drive. Now, let me, having said that, gentlemen, don't you ever tell your wife to submit. Don't you ever tell her to submit. You're abusing Scripture when you do that. The command to submit is solely given to the wife. The Bible never says, husbands, shape up that woman and make her obey. Never. God commands you to love her like Christ loves the church and lay down your life for her. That means you got no rights. That means you give up your life for her. And if you think that that's not enough to do, so you got to start bossing her around. Well, you ain't tasted the love of Jesus for you. So don't go down that road where you husbands should never demand. This is a thing that the wife has to learn. Husbands, we got enough to take care of on our own, doing what Christ commanded us, which is to love them like Christ loved the church. See, this is the strange bizarrety of relationships. And you know what? This goes way beyond marriage, doesn't it? Submission is something we are all to learn, whether you're married or not. You don't have to be married to have to know. You don't have to be a woman to have to understand submission. Hey, look, you got a boss. You work for somebody. God wants you to submit to that person. You have somebody in authority over you. You know what? Same principle works. You want to teach them how to be a better boss? You better start submitting to them. And be a good example to them. Be their best to support, even when they're a jerk. Now, that's how we teach. That's 9 out of 10 times how you teach a husband a lesson. But there is a time to intervene. And that's the thing where I think sometimes we don't always quite get it. You know, for example, I have seen gals who are being beaten and abused and where the family is in danger. And there comes a time to be an Abigail. Abigail goes against the norm and she stands up and rescues the family. That's the exception to the rule. There will be times when that has to happen. There will be times when yes, I must obey God rather than men. But I want you to understand, this is the exception to the rule. Let's move on. Verse 20. Back to Samuel, verse 20. Chapter 25, verse 20. And so she told not her husband Nabal. And it was so, as she rode on the ass, that she came down by the covert of the hill, and behold, David and his men came down against her, and she met them. She comes around the hill, and she finds David. And David said, surely in vain have I kept all that this... David's muttering to himself as he's walking down the road. Surely in vain have I kept all that this fellow hath in the wilderness, so that nothing was missed of all that pertained to him. He hath requited me evil for good. A guy just slapped me in the face. And so and more also do God unto the enemies of David, if I leave not of all that pertain to him by the morning light any that go to the bathroom against the wall. And it's very descriptive in the King James, for which we're not thankful. Okay, what is it talking about? It could be talking about males. Some of your nicer translations says, if I do not leave any males standing in the morning. It can also refer to dogs, because this is what dogs do. And the idea could be this, is that David is saying, look, I'm not going to leave so much as a dog alive at Nabal's house when we're done. David is angry. David is angry. And there's a point here. You need to deal with anger. David's not doing a good job right here. Abigail will actually rescue him from his anger. But David right now is bent on a dangerous course, and he's going to do something totally stupid. Totally stupid. It's going to ruin his reputation forever. Look at Ephesians chapter 4, verse 26. Ephesians 4, verse 26. Ephesians 4, verse 26. Paul writes this, be angry and sin not. Let not the sun go down on your wrath, neither give place to the devil. Be angry and sin not. You can be angry and get away with not sinning. We're supposed to deal with the anger. Don't stay angry. Don't let the sun go down on your anger. And I think the implication is that when we stay angry and we start doing stupid things out of anger, we're giving a toehold to Satan. We're giving him an opportunity. We're attaching hand grips to our lives that Satan can grab a hold of and whip you around and use you to do all kinds of stupid things because of your anger. What do I do with anger? Go down to verse 31. Ephesians 4, verse 31. Paul says this, let all bitterness and wrath and anger and clamor and evil speaking be put away from you with all malice. And be ye kind to one another, tender-hearted, forgiving one another, even as God for Christ's sake hath forgiven you. There's a couple things that Paul says here. First thing, though, I think is kind of important. It doesn't sound too psychologically satisfying. I think some of us would like to have, could you give me 9 steps to get out of my anger? You know, give me something to work with here, Rich. Give me something to work with here. I want 9 steps. You know what? Paul says, put it away. Stop it. He says, put it away. That's hard. I got some real good reasons to be angry. I got reasons to stay angry here. Now, don't just tell me to put it away. Paul says, put it away. Well, I can't put it away. I'm angry. And you get into arguments and you start yelling at people. Have you ever been in arguments where you're yelling at people and you're being very mean and very angry and then the phone rings and you pick up the phone and, hello? Have you ever done that? Have you ever done that? You know what? I think some of us have. And what does that tell me? You know what? I can put it away. Stop hanging on to your anger. Paul just says, I really wish he would have given me more than that. I really wish. I would like to have something. Paul just says, stop it. Stop it. Put it away. Now, he does give a couple other things. Once you put it away, he says, be kind to others. And I think that's kind of like what I do to kind of move past being angry. Start being kind to others, tender-hearted. And he says, forgiving others. Sometimes that's the very root of it, isn't it? That's the very root of why I'm angry. Is, man, I've been hurt, and I want to get back, and I should feel the right to get back. And Paul says, you need to forgive like Jesus has forgiven you. How has Jesus forgiven me? Freely and without reservation. He lets it go. I come to him and I say, Jesus, I have really messed up. Will you forgive me? And he says, yes. You need to be careful about anger. I think there's more than a few of us. Every time I speak on anger, I have all kinds of people come up to me and say, well, you were speaking to me. It's because everything's common. We get angry. A lot of us get angry. And you know what, beloved? We need to let God work in our lives and take us past that. And stop being so angry all the time. And to learn to be kind, tender-hearted towards each other. And to forgive each other. Now, David's all riled up. Let's go back and let's finish this thing up. I'm out of time. And so, so David's all riled up and And when Abigail saw David, verse 23, she hasted, lighted off the ass, fell before David on her face and bowed herself to the ground and fell at his feet and said, upon me, my Lord, upon me let this iniquity be, and let thine handmaid, I pray thee, speak in thine audience, and hear the words of thine handmaid. Let not, my Lord, I pray thee, regard this man of Belial. She calls her husband that. Even Nabal, for as his name is, so is he. Nabal is his name, and folly is with him. But that she doesn't even defend him. Yep, he is a fool. But I, thine handmaid, saw not the young men of my Lord whom thou didst send. Now therefore, my Lord, as the Lord liveth and as thy soul liveth, seeing that the Lord hath withholden thee from coming to shed blood, I mean, even though I'm glad you haven't killed anybody yet, and from avenging thyself with thine own hand, now let thine enemies and they that seek evil to my Lord be as Nabal. And now this blessing which thine handmaid hath brought unto my Lord, let it even be given unto the young men that follow my Lord. I pray thee, forgive the trespass of thine handmaid, for the Lord will surely make my Lord a sure house, because my Lord fighteth the battles of the Lord, and evil hath not been found in thee all thine days. Now, she goes on and blesses David. She goes on and kind of speaks prophetically that David's going to be king one day. It's very, very cool stuff. David turns around and says, wow, you stopped me from doing something really stupid. God bless you, sister. And he accepts the gift and he turns the guys around and says, let's go home, guys. We were about to do something really stupid. When she gets home, Nabal is drunk, stinking drunk. He's in the middle of his party. And she figures that she can't talk to him while he's drunk, which is a smart thing. She waits till the next day. He's sober. She comes to him and she says, you won't believe what happened to me yesterday. And she tells her what she did. And he goes, ugh! He's totally freaked. Totally freaked that David was on his way to wipe him out. Well, either that or some commentaries say that he was freaked that she gave away so much food. I don't know. One way or the other, he's like, ugh! And it says he was frozen for 10 days. He either had a stroke or a heart attack or something. And then after 10 days, he dies. And David finds out about it. And David praises the Lord because he realized David took care of, that God took care of the situation instead of David. And then he sends a message to Abigail and says, "Will you marry me?" And he marries Abigail. And she becomes his wife. Two last things to think about. Number one is a warning. If you are Abigail married to Nabal. First warning. First word. It's a warning. If you're Abigail married to Nabal, don't dream about David. There's a little bit of a danger with this story, that it becomes a fantasy of how I will be rescued by this knight in shining armor from my Nabal. Don't go there. If you follow the story accurately, she never sets out to destroy her husband. She sets out to rescue him. Do you see that? She doesn't know the end of the story. She doesn't know she's going to end up being married to David. She goes out to keep David from killing her husband. So I think the first word I want to say with this, if you've got some unhappiness in your marriage, don't quit on your marriage. Oh, no, no, no. You keep fighting for your marriage. Don't go dreaming about David. That's not a healthy thing to do. Second thing, just something that's kind of cool. She says in verse 24, she fell at David's feet and said, "Upon me, my Lord, upon me let this iniquity be." She says, "You know, I want you to think that it's my fault. And I want to pay for this sin." Paul will do this in the New Testament. He finds this guy named Onesimus who's a runaway slave, and he leads Onesimus to the Lord. Paul knows Onesimus' master. His name is Philemon. And he writes a letter to Philemon and he says, "You know what? I'm sending Onesimus back to you. And if he's done anything to hurt you, if he's rung up a bill of any kind, put it on my tab. I'm paying for it." Very cool thing. Very cool. You know, it's an act of love, isn't it? Isn't that an act of love? It's an act of love for Abigail, for Nabal. She says, "Consider it my sin. I want to pay for it." And you know what, beloved? That's just like Jesus. That is just like Jesus. Abigail pays a debt that brings peace between David and Nabal. She pays a debt that brings peace between David, who's come to destroy Nabal for his foolishness, and Nabal. Jesus paid a debt to bring peace between us and God. We find peace with God. We come to know God, not because we can clean up our lives good enough or because we can pay the price, but because Jesus has paid the price. Romans 5:10 says, "For if when we were sinners, we were reconciled to God by the death of His Son, much more being reconciled, we shall be saved by His life."